So a couple of weeks ago, we started this text called Hymn to Sri Dakshinamurti. And the reason we chose that, because this whole text is related to meditation. This being a meditation class, all the verses are meditative. So just to introduce for those who missed the past couple of weeks, this text is about a prayer or a praise of the Lord who is also the teacher. It's called Dakshinamurti. Dakshina means the realm of death, and the Lord has overcome death. So he is called as being able to face death. And we all are in the realm of change, in the realm of death. So we are as if we're living in the south and facing the Lord who is in the north, who has overcome death. And this picture represents the students and the teacher. And the four students were monks who were renunciates, who had studied a lot, had a lot of knowledge, but did not have the final experience. And so they went out in search of a teacher, and they found this young man sitting under a tree. And the young man was nobody other than the Lord himself. The Lord appeared in front of them to enlighten them and remove their doubts. Because when a student's search is very sincere and the thirst is very intense, then the Lord himself either appears or sends a teacher. And that's why a guru will appear or a teacher will appear when your desire to learn is very strong. And so the student was young and the teachers were old. And that's why they say it's a wondrous sight. It is strange. Normally the teacher is old and the students are young. But the Lord is described as being ever youthful, ever energetic. And the students were old because they had studied a lot, but they came. And he gave them the knowledge in silence. He did not speak, but in silence he was able to communicate with their mind and give them the knowledge. And that was the essence of the four shlokas in the Dhyan shloka, which is the on page 8. That is, these are the meditative verses. We have not yet got into the text. But this is an introductory verse which tells us who the student is, the four students, and who are the teachers, and what was the knowledge that the teacher gave to the student. But the details of the knowledge we will start from next week. Today we will finish the meditative verses or the introductory verses. So today we'll be doing verse numbers 4 and 5. So I'll just chant them, and those who know it obviously can chant with me. Verse number 4. Nidhaye sarva vidyanam bhishaje bhavaroginam gurave sarva lokanam dakshinamurtaye namaha. So dakshinamurtaye namaha. I prostrate to the Lord who is also my teacher. And in fact, everything that we have, all the teachers say, whatever I studied, physics or chemistry or biology or golf or tennis or gardening or spirituality, all knowledge has come from the Lord himself. So even though we have studied from a teacher, ultimately he is the source of all knowledge. So I prostrate to that Lord. And who is he? Nidhaye sarva vidyanam. Nidhaya means he's the storehouse. He is the treasure house of all the knowledges. Every knowledge that you can think of, the Lord is the storehouse. He is the treasure house. From him, as I mentioned, all the knowledges came, whether I'm studying physics or chemistry or golf or engineering or medicine or cooking or swimming or even the spiritual knowledge. So every teacher who has taught me anything, I need to have gratitude. But they say the highest gratitude should be to the spiritual teacher, because that is the highest knowledge. And so it is the Lord who is the storehouse of all the knowledges. And Bhishaje Bhava Roginam. And he is the, Bhishaje means he is the destroyer of Bhava Roga, or the disease of worldliness. Now that's a strange thing. Why do you say worldliness is a disease? Is this world a disease? No, we don't say that the world is a disease, but worldliness is a disease. The world is not a disease, worldliness is a disease. What do we mean by that? We're not saying that you should not work in the world. You should work in the world. You should succeed. You should do the best you can. As long as you are working in the world, it is fine. But when the world gets into you, then you are suffering from the disease of worldliness. I can be in the world, but the world should not be in me. So to give an example, a person is at work and he does a wonderful job and he's very successful. He's a very successful executive. And then he goes home and at home also he's thinking about work, even though he's with his wife and he's with his children. Instead of playing with his children, he brings all the work home. He brings all the files home to study and he has to prepare for tomorrow's presentation. And even when he's talking to the wife, he's thinking about. So he's not there with his wife and children. His duty at that moment is to be available to his family. But he has brought that world home. Either he brings it physically in the form of files and briefcase and books, or mentally, even though he's talking to his wife. And she says, honey, you're not really here. Yeah, why? Because he's still thinking about his business. He's still thinking about the dollars he's going to make tomorrow or the deals he's going to make. Or it could be the other way around. He could be at work. A lady may be at work and her child is sick at home. Yeah, of course, your child is sick, you take care. But once you have given the child the medicine, left them with the babysitter with all the instructions, and if you are at work, then you're supposed to pay attention to your work. Yes, you may call and check on your child. But if all the time while you are working or typing or doing a computer or whatever you're thinking about your child at home, then you are not really performing to your correct level, and you're not doing the job you are paid to do or what you're supposed to do. So working in the world, if you are in the world, is okay, but if the world gets into you, then that is called a disease. And what is disease? Dis-ease. If you divide disease, D-I-S-E-A-S-E, dis-ease. So a state of uneasiness. And that happens when people are not focused on what they are doing, not doing the what they are supposed to do. The other thing about it is that a person may get so involved in the world, so involved in his money making and this and clothes and jewelry and dress and la wife and children and all that, that he has no time for evolution. Who am I? What is my purpose in life? Why did I get a human birth? The main goal of human birth is spiritual evolution, to know God, to realize Him, to become one with Him. And God is nobody else but in my own heart. So the disease of worldliness is when I'm so involved in the world that I don't have time for anything better to learn or evolve. So the Lord is the one who gives me the knowledge of how to get out of this disease of worldliness. Then he says, Gurave Sarva Lokanam. And he is the guru, he is the teacher of all the worlds. In our scriptures, they describe three worlds, which are also described in the Bible and in the Quran and in the Guru Granth Sahib, where they talk about three worlds. This universe that we can see, all the planets and stars and moons. And then they describe a higher world, which they call as the heavens. And then they describe the lower worlds, which they call as the hell, or where all the demons and the ghosts and the goblins and the, all those creatures live there. So there are different worlds. There are the heavens, where all the gods and goddesses and all the angels and all the divine beings live. And then the earth, where humans and animals live. And then the lower worlds, where all the ghosts and, all those people. So it says the Lord is not only the creator of this whole universe, all the worlds, even the higher worlds, even the lower worlds, even this earth, but he's also the teacher. So again and again, he's paying homage to his teacher, who is the Lord himself. And that is what one constantly has to. So whenever you learn something or you know something, instead of becoming arrogant and saying, oh, I know so much and I can do so much, anytime you have any success, whether it is a material success, whether it is knowledge, whether it is any achieving any goal, always be grateful. Be grateful to your teachers from childhood, you know, who have taught us. And I think that is the best gift you can give, is the gift of knowledge. And that's why teachers should have a great respect in society, because they give us knowledge. And of course, the first teacher, of course, is our mother. So starting from the parents to the teachers, and then to the guru or the spiritual teachers, one should constantly be grateful. So Dakshina Murtaye Namaha. So I prostrate to the Lord who is the teacher. And the fifth verse, Om Namah Pranavarthaya Shuddha Jnanaika Murtaye Nirmalaya Prashantaya Dakshina Murtaye Namaha. So I am grateful. I prostrate to Dakshina Murti, the Lord, the teacher. Om, I have mentioned, is the symbol here, and we begin our prayer and end our meditation and begin our meditation with Om. Why do we choose Om? What is the significance of Om? Actually, to talk about Om will take probably an hour or two, because Om itself has so many meanings and means so much, but we won't spend too much time. He says, Om Namah Pranavarthaya. Pranava also means Om. So the Lord is the meaning of Om, or the Lord means Om, or Om means the Lord. So this Sanskrit, that is the beauty of Sanskrit, that depending on what is the subject or object, one sentence can have many meanings. So here it says, Om represents God, and God is the one who represents Om. So Om is one of the names of God. God, in our scriptures, we say God has thousands of names. There is the Vishnu Sahasranam, Shiva Sahasranam. So there are thousands of names of God. And also in the scriptures, and I mean, you can call him, you know, Jesus, you can call him Allah, you can call him Father in Heaven, Guru Nanak, Buddha. So those are all the names of God. But also in our scriptures, they have given thousands of names. You know, there is like a beautiful chanting of Vishnu Sahasranama and so on. Jayashree chants and memorizes them. She has them memorized. So the chanting of the name of God is a very powerful way. They say that there are a lot of things you can do in the world, but the highest action you can do is prayer. The highest action you can do is prayer. Prayer is higher than any action, anything, even service, even helping the poor, feeding the poor. Prayer is even higher. So Om is one of the names of God. So when we chant Om, we do it with the idea that we are remembering the Lord. Also, Om is said to be the first sound when the world was created. The first sound that came was Om, and that vibrated in the whole cosmos. And then from that sound came space. And then from that sound came all the world's languages, all the scriptures. And the whole creation started with Om. And that's why when you are chanting Om, Om is the vibration of the cosmos. So when you're chanting Om, and when you do it softly and slowly and, you know, with full attention, then you are, your mind is in tune with the cosmos. So that's why chanting of Om is kind of, when your mind is restless, it can be become very calm. And you are in tune with the cosmic mind. Then Om also, I have given another meaning. Because when we chant Om, we don't say Om, O-M. We say Om. You kind of drag it out. So Om can be broken up into A, U, and M. Om, A-U-M. So we are in three states. We live in three states of consciousness. We live in the waking state, which all of us are. Then when we, before, as we are falling asleep, or later on, we go into the deep sleep. And then as we are about to wake up, we usually dream. So either you dream before you fall asleep, or most of the time, just before you wake up. So we are in the waking state, in the dream state, or in the deep sleep state. Waking state, in the dream state, or in the deep sleep state. So the A in Om represents the waking state, the U represents the dream state, and the M represents the deep sleep. And also Om, if it's properly chanted, comes from all the parts of the body. The A starts from the belly, the U starts from the neck, and the M comes from the mouth. So all your faculties of speech are utilized. But interestingly, the Om has to have silence afterwards. So you chant Om, and then you don't say Om, 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 not like that. But you say Om, and then there is a previous period of silence before the next Om starts. And when you are chanting the name of God, don't just chant it mechanically, or like that. But you chant his name once, and it could be any name. It can be Father in heaven, or it can be Allah, or it can be Buddha. And then you chant the name slowly, and then you have a period of silence. So this is the waking state, the dream state, and the deep state. And the silence between two chanting of the name of the Lord is called the Turiya state. And what is the Turiya state? Turiya state is the state of awakening. When a master has woken up to that higher reality, when Jesus or Buddha or Shankaracharya or Swami Chinmayananda, when they awakened to that higher reality, which you call as God realization or self-realization, people like Eckhart Tolle and so on, they are said to be residing in that Turiya state. So Turiya state is nothing but that state of God realization. And in that state, when they experience extreme silence, extreme bliss, extreme peace. So the silence represents that silence. So the goal of our meditation, when we sit for meditation, what do? We try to make our mind quiet. You know, and we do various techniques. You relax your body, you watch your breath, you chant the name of the Lord. You watch the mind as a witness. But the goal of all these techniques is to quieten the mind, where the mind, which is running like that, is made slow. And ultimately, in the highest meditation, when your mind is completely quiet, that is when you experience that inner joy, that inner peace, which is the Lord's presence. So silence is the goal of meditation. And so that is why they say when you chant Om, don't pay attention as much to the sound as you pay attention to the silence. In between the two chants, it could be any mantra, doesn't have to be Om. Somebody could be chanting Allahu Akbar, or could be chanting the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. But you chant the mantra, but then in between the mantras, you have the period of silence, and that is what is called the silence stage, the Turiya stage. So Om represents all of those. That's why they say that Om is God. And God represents Om, and Om represents God. Then he says, Shuddha Gyan Eka Murtaye. It is one form. Here, God has only one form, but that form represents the formless. Even though we worship God in a form, in a statue or in a picture, but we understand that that statue or picture is not God. That statue or picture represents God. Like when you go to a church and you see Jesus on the cross. Now we know that this is not Jesus, but this represents the Father in heaven, the formless reality. So in all scriptures, they have some sort of a form. We go to a Buddhist temple, you have Buddha. If you go to Mecca, there is that black stone, you know, which people worship as a symbol of Lord. So symbolism is there in all scriptures, and so the symbol represents God. The symbol is not God, but it takes your attention to God. Then he says, Shuddha Jnana, which means the pure knowledge. What do we mean by pure knowledge? There can be many meanings from this. One is that our knowledge is always knowledge of something else. Say, like I can say, I have knowledge of English, but I do not have knowledge of Russian. Or I have knowledge of medicine, but I do not have knowledge of atomic physics, quantum. So my knowledge is of something. It's not knowledge by itself. But God's knowledge is pure knowledge. There is not knowledge of anything, because in the scriptures we believe that God alone is everywhere. Everything that you see in this universe is He alone. because he alone was, even the Bible says, you know, God was there and then he created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh day. So when he created the world, he alone was. So where did he create it? Out of himself. It's not that he found some matter lying around. The earth, space, fire, water, air, whatever was, he created out of himself. So he himself became this whole universe. So at the highest level, you understand that God alone is everything. And once everything is me, then there is nothing for me to know, because everything is me, myself. So God's knowledge is knowledge of he himself. So it's not knowledge of something else, but it is pure knowledge. And also it is the knowledge that is the highest knowledge. Another meaning of Shuddha Jnana is when we learn from a spiritual teacher, from a proper teacher, the knowledge is very clear. And when we study, our knowledge should be clear. It should not be doubtful. It should not be misunderstood. It should not be have maybe different meanings. This reminds me of a story of misunderstanding. This girl got married, and so she went on her honeymoon. And a week later, she called her mother. Mom, he's so wonderful. He loves me. He takes care of me. I had the most wonderful time in my honeymoon. This is the most wonderful husband I have ever had. Not ever had. Most wonderful. Most wonderful husband I could have had. She is very happy. She loves him. And mother is happy too. A week later she calls. Mother, take me away from here. So what? A week ago you said he's most wonderful. Says, mother, he does nothing but whole day use four-letter words. What? He uses four-letter words? Yup. All the time he's just using four-letter words. So mother says, what does he say? He's all the time, he's telling me, cook, iron, wash. Cook, iron, wash. That's all he tells me all day. Those are the four-letter words. So mother says, oh, that's terrible. You come home right away. Even your dad never used these words with me. He never did. So the thing is that, you know, we misunderstand. But the right knowledge is knowledge which doesn't, there is no room for doubt, there is no room for misunderstanding. So that's why he's grateful to his teacher who has given him this highest knowledge, which is very clear and which is very focused. Then he says the Lord is Nirmalaya. Nirmala, mala means dirt, Nirmala means has no dirt. He's pure. Because what is our dirt in our life? See, we all are that consciousness, that Om. But the dirt each and every one of us has is our vasanas, our negative tendencies. And because of our negative tendencies, negative desires, we have negative ideas, negative emotions, and negative actions. So vasanas is the impurity which makes me do negative things. But the Lord is free of all vasanas. He is free of all desires. He is pure. He is untouched, and that's why in all scriptures they describe him as being holy, being pure, being so Nirmalaya. And not only the Lord, but even the teacher, the spiritual teacher who has realized the truth, has become one with that Lord, then he or she goes beyond all desires. And we find in these masters, they have no personal desire. Jesus had no desire to make an empire. He could have become the king. You know, look at, you know, Saint Francis, look at all the great saints, look at Buddha. He gave up the kingdom because he wanted something. So all these spiritual masters have gone beyond Shankaracharya, Swami Chinmayananda, because they have realized the truth. And so they have become one with him. So that's why the teachers are also called as pure, Nirmalaya. Then it says Prashantaya. Shanta means peaceful. Prashanta means supremely peaceful. He is totally at peace. Because why are we not at peace? Why are we in pieces? Why? Because again, you know, I have so many conflicting desires. I have physical desires. I want this. I want to be physically healthy. I want to have a nice house, nice car. And then we have mental desires. I want people to love me. I want people to be nice to me, and, you know, all that. And then intellectually, I want to be successful. I want to get this. I want to get a million. I want to get 2 million. So constantly we are struggling, either trying to satisfy physical or emotional. Or, not that one should not try to be successful in life, but the effort should not come out of inadequacy. See, our effort comes out of inadequacy, that I am somehow incomplete, I am imperfect, I am inadequate. And by getting this and this object, or by getting this and this person, by marrying this particular person, or by getting this position or power or success, I will become complete. And so when you work out of incompleteness, then you are always disturbed, you are always agitated. But the one who has realized the truth, then he or she may work in the world, but they do not work out of incompleteness. They work out of sharing. And that's why all the great prophets and masters shared this knowledge that they had. So not with a desire to become famous or to become, you know, great or successful, but out of spontaneous outpouring of love. So that's why they say the Lord is supremely peaceful. Dakshina Murtaye Namaha. And I prostrate to that Dakshina Murti. There is one more verse which was not composed by Shankaracharya, but was composed by his student, Sureshwaracharya. He put it there. And I'll just summarize that and I'll chant it. I think Jayashri knows it. Ishvaro Guru Ratmeti Murti Bheda Vibhagine Vyomavat Vyapta Dehaya Dakshina Murtaye Namaha. So this, now Shankaracharya's student now prostrates to his own teacher from whom he had learned this knowledge and to the Lord himself. So he says, I am grateful to the teacher. Why? Because he has shown me that the creator and the teacher and me, we are all one. See, right now I think of three different people. I am this, you know, useless little creature wandering on this earth. And then there is this teacher, this realized soul, Jesus or Buddha or Guru Nanak or Muhammad or whoever, the teacher. And then there is the creator, the Lord, you know, who created the whole world. And so the teacher is telling me about God, you know, and I am studying, which is true, you know, at the beginning level, yes, I am the student. I need to approach a teacher who will tell me about God. But in the final analysis, when the final realization takes place, then the teacher, student understands that there is only one. God is only one, consciousness is only one, and this whole universe is his expression. And that's why a realized master spontaneously loves even animals and birds. We heard the stories of Saint Francis, how he could talk to wolves and talk to animals, because he could see God in everybody. So ultimately, the highest truth is that they are all one. There is no difference between me and God and the teacher. It's not, doesn't come out of arrogance, not that I am God. See, there are some prophets who go around saying, I am God and all of you should follow me. That is not realization. The realization is that I am God and everybody is God. We are all one. If somebody is misleading the followers and saying, I am God and you should all follow me, and if I say you should drink poison, you all should drink poison, like happened with that teacher Jones. That is not realization or enlightenment. The enlightenment is to understand that everybody is God. Everybody is divine, and all animals, all birds, all fish, all plants, everything has to be loved and respected. So that is the highest knowledge. And he says, I am grateful to my teacher who gave me this knowledge. Ishvara Guru Atma Iti Murti Bheda Vibhagine. One who told me that there is no difference between all three. So that is the state of realization. And then he says, Vyomavat Vyapta Dehaya. And he says, my Lord, how does he look like? You know, you always want to see, how does God look like? How can we describe him? They say God is indescribable. Yes, you can visualize him in the form of Jesus or Buddha or Krishna or Shiva. That is the symbolic form, but really God is all pervading. He's there everywhere. He's there right here, right now. He's talking through me. He's listening through all of you. He's there in the rocks, in the stones, in the floor, in the chairs. He's everywhere. How is he? He's like space. His body is like space. Now you ask me, where is space? Space is everywhere. It's here. It is within every one of us. It is outside. It extends for miles and miles and trillions of miles and billions. It can go on and on and on and on. And it seems endless. So they say God is even beyond space. Even this space, which is trillions of miles, occupies a very small part of that divine consciousness. So that divine consciousness, which is everywhere, which is all-pervading, which is even supporting space, even subtler than space, even space was created by him. So that consciousness, my Lord, he says he has a body like space. So that's why space is the closest thing to him. You know, everything else, air, water, fire, earth, you know, they are all the elements out of which this whole universe was made. And the earth is the most dense. And then there is water, then there is fire, then there is air. And subtler than air is space, because air is still something you can feel. The air is blowing and there is a tornado or a storm or whatever. But space, you can't see it, you can't feel it, you can't experience it, you can't. So they say, my Lord is even subtler than space. But the closest thing I can think of, vyomavat, vyapta deha, vyomavat, like space, vyapta. And just as space is everywhere, all pervading, space is here, there, everywhere, inside me, outside me. And even in the scriptures they say, antar bahishta tat sarvam, vyapta narayana tishtati. Narayana, the Lord, is inside me and outside and pervading everything. There is nothing in this world. Every cell of my being is multiplying, is growing because of the Lord's presence. The rocks are made of atoms, and atoms have these neutrons and protons in the middle with electrons circling. So constant activity is going on even in rocks and stones. There's nothing in this world that is dead. You might say the rock is dead. No. It is made up of billions of atoms and there is constant activity. So he says, my Lord is there everywhere. And that Lord I prostrate to. And I prostrate to my teacher who tells me about the Lord. There was a very famous saint in India who said that if God and the teacher were to both appear in front of me at the same time, whose feet would I touch first? If God is standing here and then my teacher is standing here, whom should I bow to first? He said, I should bow to my teacher first. Because without the teacher, I would have never known about God. So that is the beauty of this dhyana shloka, these meditative verses, that they recognize the role of the teacher and the role of God in our life. And that is why we always chant these before we start the study of the text. So these verses were easy. Comparatively, the next verse, which we shall do next week, is kind of very difficult. So I may have to take one class or even two classes. So I would request everybody, A, you should buy the book. Those who don't have it will have it available by next week. So read it before you come. And even though it may seem very difficult, but I'll try my best to make it simple. When you try to read it, it will seem very obtuse, very difficult, because the knowledge is, but I'll try my best to simplify it and make it available. And then there are 10 verses, and each verse talks about a different aspect of God. Like one talks about him as the consciousness that was there from childhood to youth to middle age to death. And another one talks about the Lord who was the creator of this whole universe. So each verse talks about God in a different way, and it's very beautiful. And each one of the ideas of these verses can be used by us when we meditate. So that was the idea of selecting this particular text.